This program is presented by University of California Television. Like what you learn? Visit our website or follow us on Facebook and Twitter to keep up with the latest UCTV programs.
Tell you what I'm going to talk about. The broad idea is really the work that I've done over the past few years following up on work that we did in graduate school with Jerry Dawson, thinking about the role of social motivation in autism and the interplay of experience and brain development in autism. So these are the organizations that support my research and support me, and there's no conflicts with the things I'm going to discuss today. And what I'd like to discuss is first, in a broad way, how I think about studying autism, studying neurodevelopmental disorders more broadly. And then I want to talk about this model, the social motivation model, and how it might explain some things in autism. And then some of the work that I've done since coming to Yale to test assumptions, because it really does rely on several assumptions that can be tested. And my thinking about ways that this model can be changed, can be evolved a little bit. And then some of the tools that we've developed in the lab to study social engagement, and why I think that this kind of approach to understanding autism and to understanding neurodevelopmental disorders is useful. So that's the roadmap for today. So the way I think about autism is, I call it clinical neuroscience. So I'm a clinical psychologist is my training. I've spent a lot of time interacting with people with autism, a lot of time talking with the families of people with autism, and that's really been critical for me in the way that I think about things as a scientist. I think that the clinical insight is what helps me understand what is relevant to study, and it's an opportunity for people to communicate to me what is important to the people who are affected by autism to understand. So I think that clinical insight is a really, really important tool. I think it's not sufficient. I want to know more. I want to understand how the brain is built differently in autism. And so we need tools. And so I apply the tools of cognitive neuroscience. I'll tell you a little bit about EEG, the method that I primarily use. So clinical insights to guide neuroscience and really in a developmental context. So I'll talk more about this, but really for me, it's so important to think about autism not just being something that happened to a person, but something that is continually happening, right? It's something that happens in the brain, but every minute we're making choices about what we attend to. We're learning about different things with different kinds of proficiency, and that's development. As you'll hear, the research that I do is experimental, it's empirical, but I really tie it very tightly to a theoretical framework that I'll describe to you today. And that's been helpful to me, especially as a junior scientist, really as a roadmap for the kinds of things that make sense to study. It kind of overlays a linearity in my work. A goal of our approach is to try to make the experiments that we do more like the settings in which I have these clinical insights, more realistic, more socially valid. Because a lot of the things that we've learned about how the brain processes social information are from staring at really brief presentations of a black and white picture of a face. And that's not the way that we interact with other people. It's not social. And it's not the kinds of things that people with autism have the most trouble with. So we're trying to change that. And then the last thing is translating research. And I mean this in two ways. So translational research, for those of you who aren't in the field, means that the science that you do has clinical applications. And so I certainly mean it in that way, but I also mean it in a more literal way. I mean translating research. Coming back to that first point, it's helpful to me as a clinician to be a scientist, and I think it's a useful thing to have the person sitting across the table from a family discussing what autism means in their life also being a person who's conducting the science. And so the hope is by bringing all of these things together, we can make a difference, that we can improve lives. So that's the broad approach to study that I use. I don't need to describe to you all what autism is. I want to highlight a couple of things. So we think that we define autism based on difficulties in two areas, in social and communication difficulties, and then also to rigid, repetitive behaviors and interests. So two things that I want to highlight. One is autism is a tremendously heterogeneous disorder, right? There is as much variability. If you all had autism, there would be as much variability as among you as there is today. But what's equally striking in autism is the commonality in the kinds of things that they have trouble with, right? People who range so widely, people who are much brighter than I am, who have difficulty with things that I was never taught, that I started doing when I was an infant. And so that, to me, is a starting point to try to understand what's happening, looking at these really kind of basic and common difficulties in social interaction. And as I said before, also then really thinking about these things in the context of development. Because if you are born with a brain that isn't proficient, that isn't geared to these kinds of things from the first moments of life, you're missing things from the first moments of life. You're living in a different world. And this is a slide that I have adapted from one that's used by one of my mentors, Ami Klin. And it's very useful for me to thinking about how this can work. And so most of us, we are dropped into the world glued to other people, and we spend our lives absorbing information related to other people, becoming, you know, immersing ourselves in social experience. And when we think about these kind of different developmental trajectories that people with autism experience, it's not that they're not learning. They're learning about different kinds of things and things that are less useful for the world as it's currently built. You know, when I say social today, I don't mean being the scintillating star of a cocktail party. I mean knowing how to navigate the checkout line of the supermarket, how to get onto a bus, what to say if someone bumps into you on the street. So I mean, you know, navigating the world as we live in. So I'm very interested in understanding these trajectories and understanding when they diverge, how they diverge, and whether they can be steered back up. That's another nice thing about thinking about things this way, right? It's not that the autism trajectory doesn't go anywhere. It's just going in the wrong direction, so maybe we can steer it up. I want to give a very quick primer in the tool that I use to study the brain, primarily the main tool I use, and it's event-related potentials. So ERPs are a subset of the EEG, which many of you might be familiar with from clinical settings. It's the kind of thing that we use to look for seizure activity. So EEG is just the recording of electrical activity produced by neurons that comes through the scalp. And so the way we record it, you can see here, this net is just an elastic net with small rubber pedestals embedded in it. And inside each pedestal is a small sponge, and inside that sponge is a small electrical sensor. And we just dip that whole elastic net into salt water and stretch it over a person's head. And if they can tolerate wearing that wet hat, we can record their brain activity. And so what's nice about this kind of method is that it's viable with lots of different kinds of people. It's viable with infants, it's viable with the elderly, it's viable with people with huge vocabularies, and it's viable for people who don't have any language at all. There are really specific strengths about the kind of data collected with EEG that are very interesting to me. So EEG collects data at a very, very rapid rate. So its temporal resolution is on the order of milliseconds. So what that means is that we can image brain activity as it happens. So that gives us access to different kinds of information. It lets us see whether different kinds of percepts are processed more efficiently. Are certain things processed by the brain quicker than other things? And then also whether different groups of people process things with different efficiency. And this turns out to be very relevant for understanding autism. It also lets us break down a cognitive process into pieces. So when we do something like look at a face, a lot of things happen very quickly. And with ERP, we can isolate those stages. We can see basic sensory things happening at 100 milliseconds versus higher order emotion decoding later on in the process. And so we can break that out. When we think about the practicalities of ERP and the kind of translational benefits that we want to see with our research, it's nice because it's economical. It's expensive to get an ERP system, but once you have it, it costs nothing but maintenance to collect data and to administer ERPs to people. It's scalable. There are EEG systems in every hospital in the country. And relevant to the work that I'll be describing today, the body of cognitive neuroscience research that we build from has demonstrated robust metrics of social perception from infancy through adulthood. And I'm going to show you one of them. So this is what the data from an ERP looks like. This is an ERP waveform. And that negative spike that you see highlighted in purple is called an N170, which just means it's a negative pattern of electrical activity that occurs around 170 milliseconds after seeing something. So that's fast. And so despite that being so fast, this negative peak is the brain registering a face as a face. This is work that came out of Greg McCarthy's lab at Yale in the late 90s, and they showed people many things, and they found that this early marker distinguished a face as a face. And this is data from the first study that I collected at the University of Washington. And what we did in this study is we took the actual paradigm that had been used in typical development to look at this brain marker of face perception, and we wanted to see whether people with autism would display it and whether they would be the same. And so we brought in a group of adolescents and adults with autism who were very bright, as equivalently bright as these typically developing people. And we showed them this for the faces. And what we saw, shown here in red, is that the people on the spectrum showed an N170. It wasn't that it didn't respond, but we saw a really important difference. And this is why ERP is useful. We saw a difference in the timing. So these bars represent how long it takes the brain to register the face. And you can see that red bar is longer, about 10% longer, even at this very, very early stage of face processing. So we looked at the ERPs, and then we also wanted to get a sense of behavior. And so we looked at people's ability to recognize faces. We used just a standardized neuropsychological test for face memory, and we found that people on the spectrum had more trouble with face recognition. And we saw that how well they performed was actually related to how quickly their brain processed this information. And so we sat down with Jerry Dawson and Sarah Webb, who was a postdoc at the time, and we tried to think of how we would interpret this. And so rather than thinking that this was the core of autism, we thought, okay, maybe we're seeing a symptom. We see that people on the spectrum have more trouble with face recognition. We see that they're slower, and we see that these two things go together. Well, we know that how quickly you process something is a marker of specialization. And so maybe what we're seeing here is a problem with specialization. Maybe people with autism aren't getting the right kind of experience. Maybe they're not driven to the right kinds of information. And so we're seeing this as a downstream effect. So if we think of what we're measuring as this, as neural specialization, the model that we kind of drew up, we called the social motivation hypothesis, was the idea that this is a reflection of inadequate experience during development, which we thought would be a reflection of not paying attention to the right kinds of things, not paying attention to people during important times when you're developing. And our speculation was that this would be an effect of decreased social motivation, that people with autism weren't driven to engage with other people in the same way. And we didn't think about it this way at the time, but now it occurs to me, too, that we could really close the circle, right? Because we're going to be much more inclined to engage with things that we can process efficiently, that we're good at. And so this is kind of where we were. And it occurred to me that this model, this way of thinking about things, really makes a few important assumptions. And we could put these in the form of questions, of tests. And so one assumption is that this piece here, I'll use the pointer, that this piece works. So we're saying that this is inefficient because of this whole cycle, but it's also possible, what if brains just can't specialize in the same way in autism? And this is a reasonable hypothesis. Maybe the information is too complex. So we can look at that. We could see if a person gets the right kind of experience, do their brains show typical kinds of specialization? Another question that's really important to answer is it just a problem with the way we're doing the experiments? If people with autism aren't looking at the right things, or the things we assume they're looking at during an experiment, could that make their brains look differently? And we can test that also. We could see whether just atypical attention, not over the course of development, but in that experiment, is just causing these differences. And then finally, we could look and really test whether this cycle seems to be true. Do variations in social motivation predict specialization, predict efficiency? And these are the kinds of studies that I've done over the past few years. I'm going to talk about some of the results, beginning with experience. So I told a small untruth before when I said this is a face response. So it starts out as a face response, but it actually turns out when we treat other things like faces, when we get really, really good at distinguishing among things that are all very similar, we co-opt these brain systems. And faces are all very similar. It's really remarkable how good we are all at telling faces apart. I've tried to do it with monkeys, for example, and I can't tell monkeys apart, but monkeys are probably as variable as we are. And so we find that when you get really good, when you get to be a bird expert, or when you get to be a car expert, and you're really good at efficiently distinguishing among things that are generally similar, you see these brain regions get involved, the fusiform gyrus, the superior temporal sulcus, and we see an enhanced N170. And so it's a nice idea. We could see whether people with autism specialize for things that they have a lot of experience with. But it's challenging, because what you need to do that kind of experiment, there's two ways. You can either force people to become experts in something, or you can find a bunch of people who are all expert in the same thing. And forcing people to become experts in something, I think, misses out on a key piece of the way we learn about faces, and for that matter, the way bird experts learn about birds. Right? There's an affective involvement. We're engaging with these things because we're interested, because we enjoy it. So I think that's not perfect. The alternative possibility, looking at things that people are naturally expert in, is nice, but it's much harder to do an experiment, because then you have to find a group of people who are, first of all, on the spectrum, and second of all expert in the same thing. So if we wanted to look at specialization and see if it's related specifically to the social domain or other domains, we could compare. We could look at brain response to social information for faces and then compare it to brain response associated with specialization in other areas. And so what you see there on your right is this is a pseudo letter. So this is from an experiment created by a guy named Alan Wong, who's now in Hong Kong. And what he found is that when you compare a response to a made-up alphabet with response to an alphabet that you can read, you see an N170 marker there. So what we can do here is look at this in people on the spectrum and say, okay, if it's just a brain that can't specialize, then we should see problems in both areas. But if it's something related to this social development, then we should see problems only here. And so that's exactly what we did. And when we looked at social things, we saw the same kinds of things that we'd seen in our prior work. So we saw more difficulty with face recognition, and we saw a slower brain response at the N170 as well. What we didn't see in this study, we hadn't looked in the other study, we looked here, were for differences at a sensory component called the P1. And people with autism looked fine at this more basic component. When we looked at the non-social things, we saw a little bit of a different picture. We saw that the people on the spectrum performed just like the typically developing people. They performed in the average range, comparable in terms of both word reading and decoding of nonsense phonemes. And when we looked at their specialization for letters, we saw that they looked just like the typically developing people there as well. So both groups showed this stronger N170 response to letters that they could read, which is showing us that their brains have specialized. And we didn't see any inefficiencies. We didn't see differences in latency. And so if we relate these back to the questions that we voiced, we can see that does typical specialization develop with experience? Well, at least in the case of letters, it does. And so this piece of the model checks out. The next question that we wanted to ask is whether or not attention in the context of experiments could explain away these delays. And we looked at this in two ways. So one way that we looked at it is with eye tracking. There's a huge volume of literature using eye tracking to understand face perception in autism. And some things are really consistent and really clear. When we show people with autism dynamic, socially realistic things, they look at them differently. When we show them static faces, the kind of faces that we use in an ERP experiment, it's a more mixed bag. And so what we wanted to know is how people with autism are looking at faces in the context of our ERP experiments. And this was dissertation work done at the University of Washington. And so what we did was we showed people a group of different kinds of images designed to be, you know, very similar or very dissimilar to faces. And what we found is that we measured where they looked. In this kind of situation, people with autism looked very similar to the typically developing people. They showed more fixations to the eyes. They looked more time to the eyes. And so this suggests to us that it's not just a question of looking at different places in the context of an ERP experiment. But it's not that doesn't measure it directly, and we can. So we approached it in another way. We used ERP to measure how the brain responded differently to different kinds of attention to the face. So we know that you get a faster brain response when you direct a person's attention to the eyes. And so it's a real problem, right? If we're making a lot of slower brain responses in autism, it's really important to demonstrate that it's not just a function of not looking to the eyes. And so to look at this, we made an experiment where we had a crosshair appear on the screen, and then a face followed the crosshair. So that way we could control where a person was looking. So we had a task. They had to be paying attention to the task, to the crosshair, to perform this task. And we directed attention to the eyes, to the nose, and to the mouth. And what we found is that it didn't matter. So no matter overall if we looked at it as we had looked in the original analyses, we found that people on the spectrum showed longer latency overall, and then we broke it into individual features, we saw that people with autism were slower across the mouth, the nose, and the eyes. And it was only the typically developing people who were showing this faster responsiveness to the eyes. And so that addresses our second question. So at least in these experiments, we're seeing delays are independent of attention during the experiments. Even when we make a person with autism look to the eyes, their brains are still showing this lack of specialization for social information. So the third question is really thinking about this cycle broadly and whether we can see differences here that predict differences here. And so we wanted to know, does variability in motivation predict specialization? And we actually approached this in a little bit of a different way. This was the graduate work of a woman named Celeste Chung. And Celeste actually looked at variability in a different group of people, in typically developing people. We know that social drive is variable across the spectrum and across typical development. And we know from John Constantino's work using the social responsiveness scale that autism isn't a precipice off of which one falls. It's the end of a distribution. And so what Celeste did is looked at people in the typically developing population who were at ends of a distribution. And so she brought people into the lab who were extremely extroverted or extremely introverted. And she administered really a classic version of a face processing ERP paradigm. She showed them faces that are upright and faces that are upside down. And a funny thing happens when you turn a face upside down. First of all, it gets much harder, disproportionately harder to recognize. But you also see, rather than the ERP response going away, you see the ERP response get bigger and slower. And that's called an inversion effect. And that's also a marker. I've been talking about speed as a marker of specialization, but this inversion effect is also a marker of specialization, something that emerges over time as humans develop. And this is what an inversion effect looks like. This is the data from the people who are very extroverted. So this is called an inversion effect. The dotted line is the brain response to the upside down faces. And we see that when these people view faces, they get a stronger, slower response. And we interpret this as a marker of specialization. When we did the exact same thing with the people who were more introverted, we saw a very different picture. We saw that they didn't show any inversion effect at all. And so we interpret this as a reduction in specialization. And it's interesting, these were people we screened for people with any kind of psychiatric difficulty. These weren't people who were secretly on the spectrum or people who were socially anxious. These people didn't have clinical difficulties. But we're seeing in these people who were functioning just fine a difference in a different kind of way. They're not showing frank delays. They're just showing it a difference at a more sophisticated marker of specialization. And so when we think about that in the context of the questions that we've asked before, we would say, yeah. So we see that variability in motivation does predict specialization. And so these are some of the kinds of ways we've tried to test assumptions. And as I interpret these data, it suggests that this kind of developmental pathway is a reasonable way of thinking about things. But that's not to say that it's right. And I think that there are some problems with it. And so maybe a way to think about this is, instead of having social motivation be the crux here, think about something a little more general. Think about a social engagement. But then think about ways that we could study it in a more nuanced way, to unpack it. And so when we see boys like that first clip, yeah, it still does seem to be a matter of motivation, a difference in drive to engage with others. But when we think about the second example, there could be other factors. Even in people who are driven to engage, there could be factors that push them away, that discourage them. Things like anxiety, things like learning, things like bad experiences. And then a third thing that I think is important to understand too, because it's all a little bit circular, the idea that we are driven to something or repelled from something, that really presumes that we can accurately parse what that thing is or is not, right? And so we also have to be able to detect what's social or not. And I think that at points of our life, very, very early in development, where it might be, you know, that those might be the kind of mechanisms at play. Are we picking up what is social and what isn't? And so these are the additional ways that I've come to think about this model over time. And what I want to talk about is some of the tools, some of the experiments that we've designed to try to measure these different kind of constructs. And so I want to begin by talking about drive. And we're looking at drive in two different ways. First, by just looking at reward sensitivity. So when people talk about drive and autism, and the way we originally thought about it when we wrote about the social motivation model, is a problem with reward. And so we could think about reward in general, that maybe the reward system isn't working correctly in autism, or we could also think about it in a slightly more nuanced way, to think that maybe there's different kinds of reward, and maybe people on the spectrum are having difficulties in a particular kind of reward. And I'm going to talk about two experiments that we've done to look at these things. So the first is looking at reward sensitivity. And this was an experiment designed to look at an ERP component called the FRM, which is believed to reflect activity in the anterior cingulate cortex. And so we see an FRM when we get feedback about an outcome that is suboptimal. You know, when we're pulling the slot machine and we don't win, that's an FRM. So people have looked at this before. In fact, Michael South, who was trained by some of the experts right here, had done a study looking at FRN to winning or losing money. And so what we want to do here is try to make that kind of experimental paradigm a little more analogous to social feedback, because social feedback is more ambiguous. And so the way that we made it more ambiguous is, instead of having money taken away, we had it that you can win money or nothing can happen. So before it was win or lose, this is win or draw. And this is what the experiment looked like. It's you pick a balloon, and you can either see a white square, which says nothing happened, or you can see the dollar sign, which means that you've won money. And at the end of a block, you can see the money you've won falling into a glass jar. Children love this experiment. I worry a little bit about the ethics of it, if I'm raising a generation of gamblers on the spectrum. But we'll know. So what we found in this study is that we didn't see differences between the two groups. So looking at this measure of, you know, reward sensitivity to reward outcome, even we made the feedback more ambiguous, we saw a really similar response in people on the spectrum and typically developing people. And this is what the response is. So this is the FRN. So this third, this panel here. So these are the people on the spectrum, and these are the typically developing people. And you can see both groups show that differential, a stronger amplitude response to the suboptimal outcome. And so there wasn't a group difference, but then moreover, when we looked at how this brain response related to things that we think are relevant to understanding autism, like symptoms or social function, we didn't see any relationship. So this kind of thing seems to work just fine. So we next thought about it in terms of social versus non-social reward. And this was the work of a really talented graduate student by the name of Anthony Cox. And so Anthony wanted to develop a paradigm that contrasted brain response to social rewards versus non-social reward. His reasoning is that the kinds of difficulties that we see in people on the spectrum are most pronounced for social information. And he also thought that the idea of a generic reward system problem didn't make sense, because people on the spectrum find some things typically rewarding, and they find some things hyper-rewarding, right? We call those circumscribed interests. And so Antony wanted to look at it in a more nuanced way, and this is not... You know, it's not a new question. It's a question that people have looked at. Gabriel Dichter and others have really tried to hammer down this difference. But what Antony saw is that there were difficulties with the kinds of experiments that have been built in the past. So a classic kind of example of a social, non-social reward paradigm is to contrast brain response to smiling faces versus brain response to money. And so there's a couple of things. It's not clear that money is not social, right? If I get money, that's very social to me. I'm going to buy something for my kids or take my wife out to dinner. It's also not clear. A smiling face, it's social in the sense that it's a person, but it's a different, you know, it's a different kind of social. I mean, for example, I would, not having any social deficits, I'll take the $5 over the smiling face any day. And so what Antony wanted to do was to try to build something a little more realistic, a little more ecologically valid. And so he used a deception. He had people come into the lab, and they spun a spinner, and they were either going to be the observer and watch someone else play a game, or they were going to play the game. And they were always playing the game. But they were led to believe that they were being observed by another person. And so this way we could have social feedback that was at least nominally more social. The feedback would be, this person giving feedback on their performance from a closed circuit TV. The non-social condition was food. They could pick a candy that they liked, and they would see that candy being dispensed into a container that they would get on a closed circuit TV. And then there was a non-reward condition, and that was just looking at a gray shape. And so this is really nascent work. It's not even published yet, and this is work that Antony did in typically developing people to try to understand what it meant for autism. Is he looked at it in terms of autistic traits. So people completed the SRS, and he grouped them into people with high levels of autistic traits and low levels of autistic traits. And what he found was interesting, when he looked at people's report of their experience, everybody said the same thing. Everybody said that the people and the candy are rewarding and the non-reward is not rewarding. There weren't differences between the groups. But when we looked at brain response, and here we were looking at a component called the P300, and we saw that both groups, so here the blue line is the people with lower scores on the SRS, so lower levels of autistic traits, and the red line is people with higher scores. And so you can see that both groups, if you compare non-reward to the non-social reward, you can see that both groups showed a stronger brain response to reward. But when we look at social, we saw this really, really striking difference where people with lower levels of autistic traits show a much stronger brain response, and people with higher levels actually show an attenuated brain response. And so the first question that I had for Antony was, maybe we're just seeing some kind of arousal-related thing. Maybe these people are more responsive to reward, period. But what's really interesting that argues against that is when we look at how their report of autistic traits relates to their brain response, there aren't effects overall. So their brain response is only really related to autistic traits when we look at the brain response to social reward. So we think that he's onto something, but we're really only getting started with this line of research. This is something that we're just now starting to actually look at in people on the spectrum. So we don't know if what we see in autistic traits will relate to autism itself. Going back to the model, I want to talk a little bit about some of the approaches we've used to look at discouragement. And we've approached this in two different ways so far. One is looking at social exclusion, the experience of being ostracized, and the other is the ability to regulate your negative affect. And I'm going to talk about these studies briefly because of time, but for social exclusion, we used a paradigm that's called cyberball. So cyberball is a very, very simple, we're talking Pong simple kind of video game with three stick figures on a screen, and they throw a ball around. You're one of the stick figures, and they throw a ball. And eventually in the game, they stop throwing the ball to you. You're excluded from the interaction. They just throw to each other. And this sounds so silly, but it is remarkable how consistently this gets people upset. There's a name for it. It's called ostracism distress. And so a colleague, Michael Crowley, built an ERP version of this paradigm, and we administered it to people on the spectrum, to children on the spectrum. And what we found is when we look at their experience of playing the game, very similar to other children. They reported the same levels of being left out, which I think is really important unto itself, right? Because you might say, oh, autism is a problem with social interaction. Maybe they don't notice. Maybe they don't care. No, that wasn't the care, the what we saw at all. It stung as much as it stung for anybody else. But we saw a different kind of brain response. We looked at two components, an early component, fast, called the P2, and a later component called the late slow wave. And what we found, this late slow wave, based on how it related to report of distress, this late slow wave, we think, represents kind of the hurt, so to speak, the emotional arousal that you're experiencing in this context. And we saw the people on the spectrum, same kind of brain activity to the typically developing people in that situation, in that part of the waveform. When we looked at an early component that we think represents cue sensitivity, discriminating what's happening there we saw that people with autism were much less responsive. They had a much weaker response to rejection. And so the way we interpreted this is that it really, rather than being a numb to exclusion effect, it's more of a salt in the wounds effect. It hurts as bad as it hurts anybody else, but they're less equipped to kind of pick up on the cues to understand that situation. Another way that we looked at it, this is a collaboration with Dennis Sokolowski, who's a professor of the Child Studies Center who does outstanding work in cognitive behavioral treatments, and he's developed a cognitive behavioral treatment for irritability or aggression for people on the spectrum. And what we find is that he has a 10-week course of treatment, and we see behaviorally that over time, on a measure called the Aberrant Behavior Checklist, scores on irritability go way down. And then what we do is we build an ERP paradigm. We haven't really built it. We borrowed it. This was used previously by Mark Lewis. And there's a task where your performance can remain consistent, but how well you do goes down. So you can imagine this would make you feel frustrated. And so we see a brain response. It's hard to see here, but these red lines kind of represent the red and the green represent the difference between these conditions. And this is a condition where you're being frustrated, and this is where your performance is fine. And so this is literally a study of one person. It's very unusual to see differences in ERP data of one, but this is pilot work that we're doing. And what we find is that before treatment, you can see there's a much stronger response to frustration than after treatment. And so it's really interesting, really neat to see that as the behavior changes, we're seeing differences in brain activity. And the hope is with these kinds of approaches, eventually that we'd be able to see based on differences beforehand, who's going to respond. And I'll talk more about those ideas in a little bit. So this is those are some of the ways that we're looking at discouragement. And the last thing I want to talk about is some of the work that I think is most exciting in the lab is the work that we're doing to understand detection. And we're looking at this in two ways. So we're looking at it in terms of eye contact, which I think of as something that happens so early in life that is so striking and so important. And also in terms of sensitivity to different kinds of information, really to try to track those different pathways that we spoke of at the start, sensitivity to biological motion and sensitivity to audio-visual synchrony, which I'll tell you more about in detail. So first I wanted to tell you about the work that we're doing to understand eye contact. So one of the things that is so interesting to me about eye contact is that it only exists between two people. So I started off today talking about how a lot of the tools that we use are passive and not interactive. And if you want to study eye contact, you really need to have some kind of interaction. You need to have someone making eye contact with you. And so this is something that we've really pursued in a long-term way. And this is the work that I'm talking about is the work of Adam Naples, who's a postdoctoral fellow and who's really gifted in a lot of ways. And so the first thing that Adam did was create a set of, he used movie animation software to create a set of faces that are really highly realistic, but are computer controlled, so he can make them do what he wants. And we started off in a very different way. We started off actually trying to use pictures of people and morphing them to animate them. But there's a number of problems with it. Among them, that unless you're sampling Brad Pitt and George Clooney, their depictions of facial expressions are not convincing. So Adam built these faces that are really realistic, but are really capable of being controlled, of making movements that are consistent with the human musculature and the human skeletal structure. But we can control really precisely, which is really important for ERP experiments. So Adam built these faces, and then we built them into experiments. And what we did was we brought together the imaging technique that we use, EEG, and eye tracking to measure where a person looks. And so this is complicated to do because we're using two methods that really need to be precisely timed. And so what Adam has succeeded in doing is having the eye tracker and the EEG work together in such a way that the EEG experiments are controlled by a person's eye contact. So we've then used these faces that he's built, so we can put these faces on the computer screen, and we can have a face on a computer screen that responds to a person's eye contact. And then we can measure how their brain responds to that face. And so I was describing the situation to a colleague, Laura Klinger, who's at UNC, and she got this faraway look in her eyes, and she said, "Jamie, you're measuring true reciprocity." And I said, "I am going to use that term every time I give a talk from now on." And so credit to Laura Klinger. But really, this is something that has been very elusive to us, but we're very interested in understanding. And so this is the experiment that I'm going to show you a video of, is the first proof of concept that we did. We actually are using some different equipment now. But what's happening here are a few things. So a cue comes on the screen. The cue is either an arrow to have a person look up or down. Nothing happens unless a person looks. The other nice thing about the eye tracking and the EEG is we can really tightly control attention. So nothing ever happens in these experiments unless a person looks where they're supposed to look. So when they look to the arrow, a face appears on the screen. They then look to the eyes if the arrow's pointing up, or they look to the mouth, and then the face responds by either opening its eyes or opening its mouth. And so there's four things that can happen. You can look to the eyes, and the eyes look back at you, and that's what we're interested in, that's eye contact. You can look to the eyes, and the mouth opens. You can look to the mouth, and the mouth opens. Or you can look to the mouth, and the eyes open. We're less interested in those other conditions, but we want to understand. So this is what it looks like. This is one of the very, very few times where you want laser beams shooting from a child's eyes. Okay, so that's what it looks like. And so what we found was really striking. So people had looked at ERPs to moving faces before, but never in a way where you were controlling for where they look and for having it synchronized. And so what we found is this really specific brain response to eye contact. And so we saw it in two places. So this is the N170 we've talked about. And you can see these are all the other movement conditions. And it's much larger to eye contact. We also saw another component called the P300, and the same thing. And these are typically developing adults. This was the first work that we did. And what we found is that in these typically developing adults, their sensitivity, so we created an index by kind of looking how sensitive they were to eye contact versus other forms of movement, and it related to how they reported social behavior on the broader autism phenotype questionnaire and autism, also on the autism quotient. So we're seeing it relating to social behavior in typical development. And then we really only started to look at this in autism. And the data that I'm showing you is preliminary and pilot. We just got an R01 funded to do this work in a larger group, so we'll know more soon. But what we find is when you look at, these are children. So this blue line is the brain response, the P300. In the typically developing kids to eye contact. And the yellow line is the brain response in children on the spectrum. And so you can see that there's a much weaker response in people with autism. And we did something unusual here because we were required to do it by grant reviewers, but we plotted the individual data. And so each horizontal line represents a person. And so what you see here that's really, really rare, we've never encountered this in our data before, and I think it's very uncommon. Most differences that you hear in autism are differences in group means, which is informative. It helps you understand how the brain works, but it's not as useful if you want to do things like predict an individual's response to treatment or measure an individual person's change. And so what we're seeing here is that there's not any overlap. So we're seeing two totally different distributions in this small sample, and we'll see if it bears out. So we're using some other kinds of analytic methods to try to really make this something that can be meaningful at the level of a person. And so we're collaborating with a group in Germany, Peter Koenig and Michael Plokel, who are really, really good at cleaning EEG data when you're using paradigms that require eye movements, because eyes produce a strong electrical activity. And so we need to get that out. And so what we can do, what you're seeing here, these waveforms look clean, but this is actually the data from one person. And so even when we do this paradigm in an individual, we can see the specific eye response in the right hemisphere, which is what we want for the kinds of translational goals that we have. So I want to show you, this is the next step. This is one of the hopes for this. But if we can measure where a person is looking during an experiment, then we could also shape where a person is looking during an experiment, right? And so what you'll see here is a prototype of something that we're working now through funding from the Patterson Trust to build into a gaze responsive game, so that we could shape looking in the right places. And so what you'll see here on the right, you see where a person's looking. On the left, you see what they see. And so a person, when they look to the face looks back to them. And if they look to the eyes, the face smiles at them, which is what we want. And so what we're doing now is building these into games where a person gets points for maintaining eye gaze. We're building them into games where it doesn't have to just be the face. There can be things on screen, like joint attention targets. And if you successfully follow the gaze of the face, or if you direct the gaze of a face, you can win points. And so the idea is that we could, you know, maybe have a therapeutic tool, but also be able to watch the brain as it learns, right? Because with ERP, we're looking at this on a trial and by trial basis. So we could see the brain changing as people, as behavior change. And we're also interested, some of the work that we're starting to do now is see if we can kind of if this brain response is malleable, if we can potentiate that plasticity by administering oxytocin. So that's the eye contact work. We want to do it in infants. We see infants regularly. We're adapting the technology and trying to get good through collaborations with other people at Yale, like Fred Schick, to try to learn how to do the eye tracking and get the gaze contingency working in infants. For the time being, we're looking at infant development in a different way. So I started out talking about these different pathways, and we're interested in studying in our infant studies kind of trajectories along both of those ways. So we want to understand sensitivity to social information. And for that, we're using these point light displays of biological motion. So what I hope you see is a person at left and nothing at right. Those are just phase scrambled dots. And very, very early in life, babies preferentially attend to the people. We're looking at brain response to those biological motion stimuli. Even in infancy, you can see very, very fast responses within 0.2 seconds. The brain treats these moving dots differently. And so we're looking at those in infants to try to chart the sensitivity to biological motion. But then we also want to understand whether there could be... So one possibility is that people on the spectrum are less sensitive to the social information, but there could also be competing kinds of information that are drowning it out. And so the way we're looking at that, following up on the work done by Ami Klin and Warren Jones, looking at audiovisual synchrony, is looking at response to different kinds of sensory information that occurs discreetly or in unison. So we play sights, we play visual percepts and sounds, and they can happen independently or they can co-occur. And you see a really specific brain response, a summation that is indicative of cross-modal integration. And so we're looking at that as a way to chart this other pathway. And what we see so far is actually very interesting and really aligns with the kinds of work that's emerged from the Baby Sibs group here, is that we see a falling off. That kids on that we don't know yet who will develop autism and who won't, but the high-risk children seem to be fine up until a point, and then we start seeing an attenuation of the typical brain response. So that's the work that's going on. The last thing that I want to talk about is why I think of this as useful, why I think it's helpful to draw boxes and connect them with arrows. And part of it relates to my clinical training. So in psychology, if someone came to me in the clinic and said, we need to know why this child isn't learning in school, his IQ is 85, I would say, I can't help you. I mean, that doesn't tell me anything, right? That's a gross measure. I want to, that IQ score alone is made up of 10 subtests. Give me his performance on those subtests. Even better, let me do a neuropsych test and understand whether his visual working memory is good or his auditory memory. What's good? What does he have trouble with? We look at it in a nuanced and detailed way. And I think this makes a lot of sense, but I think that we don't always apply it in neuroscience, right? Today, I've spent a lot of time talking about one little thing, N170 latency, which is a part of a much bigger and much more complex picture that we can study in an efficient way. I mean, so this is a figure from a grant from work that I've done with Raphael Bernier at the University of Washington, and all this information can be collected really efficiently. In a 500 millisecond presentation of a moving face, we can extract metrics of basic visual processing. We can look at structural encoding. This is your brain registering a face as such. We can look at higher order processes like emotion decoding or identity recognition, and we can see how these relate to things like mirror neuron system activation. And so this is where we want to move, to be able to look at multiple facets of the cognitive process, of the social cognitive process, both to understand isolated stages, but then also to understand it as a system. So when we collect that kind of data, then we can use multivariate statistics to actually see how these systems, how these pieces of a process are working in synchrony or failing to. And so this is an example. So these are our data from the study that we did with Rafe's group at the University of Washington, and we did just what we said. From a 500 millisecond presentation of faces, we pulled out these different things and then used statistics to see how they related to one another. And these are from typical adults, but what we find is that autistic traits predict your sensory response. They predict your mirror neuron system response, and then your sensory response is actually predictive of face of your response in terms of face structural encoding. So we can really look at these kinds of things in the context of these frameworks. We can really apply empirical methods to learn from the data about how things are working together, which I think is important for what we want to do. So if we think about these systems, each part, each discrete element that we're measuring is a potential treatment target. It's a potential measure for how people are responding to treatment. It's a potential tool to test for difficulties in autism going awry before we might pick up on them in the clinic. We can use it as a tool to look for effective connectivity across this entire system. And then by creating these profiles, we can get a more nuanced sense of individuals, we hope, so that we can look at not just a deficit in N170 latency, but a profile of what a person's brain responds efficiently to and inefficiently to across a number of domains. And we hope that's an inroad to doing the kinds of things that we as a field need to do, figuring out which treatments are going to work for which kinds of people, for understanding how to tell if a person is responding to a treatment before we've sunk years into it, and also for trying to figure out who is who. We define autism in a purely behavioral way, and we're going to have a much, much stronger power to understand genes and brain and clinically relevant things if we can figure out subgroups of kids on the spectrum. So that's the work that we do. That's why we do it. I'm fortunate to collaborate with many people around the country and around the world, and I want to acknowledge them. Most importantly, I want to acknowledge the children and the families who spend their time coming in to work with us. It's very much a partnership. And the people who have done a lot of the work that I've talked about today, the lab, and I have to, because this is going to be on a video on the internet, I have to explicitly apologize to I don't have a home computer. We moved, and so I can't download the most recent lab photo. So I know Hannah Ruman and Emily Levy will be upset that they're not pictured, but they are with us in text. So thank you to you and to the lab. And I always like to end with this slide. Julie Wolf is a clinical psychologist that I work very closely with, and she runs sibling support groups for people on the spectrum. And last year, holiday time, she did a wish bucket, and all of the kids wrote a wish, crumpled it up on a piece of paper, and threw it into the bucket. And there were the standard, you know, I want a Xbox 360, I want a new bike, but one of the ones she pulled out was, I hope that scientists find a cure for autism, and that's why we are all here. So thank you so much for your time and for your kind attention.
Well, my first question is, I was wondering if when you had the EEG monitors on the people with autism, if they're giving you the same kind of response to the social smile as the people who are typically developing. Because I found myself even smiling as I was looking at the animated figure smile, but I'm not as sure if you're getting that same response with people with autism.
It's a good question. The most straightforward answer is we have no idea because we haven't yet done the study. We haven't yet done the reciprocal smiling study. It's things like that have been studied some already, so that the jargon for it is kind of automatic mimicry. And so people with autism do show less automatic mimicry of facial expressions. So probably not. So probably they would be responding to the smiling faces differently from you.
And my other question was, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the cognitive behavioral therapy that was 10 weeks long.
Sure.
To help remediate some of the behaviors that you were seeing.
Sure. And to get the best answer, you all should invite Dennis to come and speak, but I'll talk a little bit about it. So Dennis had developed, and the acronym is going to elude me, but Dennis had developed an anger management program for use in typically developing adolescents, and then he's gotten more and more involved in work with people on the spectrum, and has adapted it for that. It's a 10-week. It involves working directly with the child and working with the parent. It's manualized. It's designed on strategies, kind of cognitive reframing, and also kind of emotion regulation, calming yourself down. But we're collecting more data, but that was just striking results in a first person. But the name is SUKHODOLSKY, and he's published on it, I believe, in Typical Development. I don't think any of the autism data is published yet. He's also done it for anxiety as well, an adaptation for anxiety.
I was really interested in sort of the virtual faces you had, and I realize this is still sort of an emerging area for you. One thing I noticed when they were smiling, it was focused only on the mouth movement and not yet the eyebrow movement,
right,
which goes along with a genuine smile. And if you were to ever use this as sort of a training system for children with autism, would you try to enhance it more so it they are really learning what a genuine smile is versus disingenuous?
So it shouldn't be. So the way Adam approached him, he actually used the FACS system to try to hit the muscles that should be changing in a smile. So they should be smiling with the eyes as well. Maybe it's not as salient as real faces, but they should be. But yeah, we try to be pretty attentive to that. What we try to do is, so the FACS system is a coding system for facial expressions that was developed by Paul Ekman, and it's down to the musculature of the face. And so what Adam tried to do was use that as cues for what to change. Because it's tough to say, you know, I'm going to make a fear face. If it's not your job to animate faces, it's really tough to approach in a kind of organic way what to do to make someone look fearful. And so that was the way he approached it. And he's actually, the stimulus set will be freely available. He's submitting it as a manuscript, as a tool for psychophysiological research. So anybody's welcome to use them.
In your model of a 500 millisecond evaluation, which sounds really exciting.
No. And please, my gosh, please don't take that soundbite out of context. 500 milliseconds per face across, 400 faces or something like that.
Well, it's just so exciting to think that one can extract this important information that way. You talked about sensory processing, that you did sensory processing. What does that mean?
Say sensory processing here, I'm really talking about it in a crude sense. I'm talking about it when I think about the process of the brain decoding what's in a face, I think, and really the way that people have studied historically, there's certain things that we understand. And so there's a component called the P100, which is a really basic stage of processing. It's very fast. It's over kind of visual cortex. And it's really the low-level properties, this low-level sensory properties, but as related to face processing. So not only visual, not across domain, not in a way someone would think about sensory, in the way we think about, you know, treating sensory behaviors in autism. So I really mean it as the sensory relevant stage of face processing. Sure. And these are things that we're trying to do. I mean, all the work that I talked about today is visual. And that's really a reflection of the limitations of my expertise and the amount of time that I've had to do stuff. I don't plan only to look at visual stuff. There's some things that are easy to look at with ERP, like auditory, which we're starting to do increasingly. There's some things that are really hard to do with ERP, like tactile sensory information, which, you know, Dr. Saran doing here is one of the few places in the world who's looking at that.
Thanks for a really great talk. I was going back to one of the first things you talked about, which was looking at characters and looking at faces and talking about expertise. And I'm not sure I caught the point properly, but I think you were arguing that people with autism were the same as people with typical development in interpreting the characters, the alphabet letter and the nonsense letter.
In a really primitive way.
I was wondering if there might be any superiorities. Because, you know, others have spoken about people with autism and having visual processing superiorities.
So, no. So there weren't. I'll first make another qualifier. I'm thinking that when we're looking at M170, which is the component we were looking at there, we're really thinking kind of orthography. So not even interpreting. You know, so and actually the study that I borrowed that from used kanji. So it compared pseudo letters, regular letters, and kanji, and showed that it was Chinese characters, and if you could read English and Chinese, you got a bigger response to both. If you could only read English, you only got a bigger response to English, and nobody gets bigger responses to pseudo letters. But I think in terms of cognition, I would relate it to orthography, kind of recognizing letter as a letter. I didn't see in that data any hyper-responsiveness in autism. It's certainly something that we consider, and we didn't see hyper-responsiveness in terms of the behaviorals, but what we can do, and we intend to do, and actually a student submitted something like this for MFAR this year, is scan that group of people, because it was a pretty large sample for that study, and look for people in there who are hypolexic. And so for those of you who aren't familiar, hyperlexia is the idea that there's a group of people, about 10% of people on the spectrum, who learn to read precociously and are very, very drawn to letters. And so it's a good question. We don't know yet, but it's something that the study was built to look at. So people in that study also completed a special interest survey, and so we'll be able to pull out people who had a kind of hyper interest in letters. So I want to know. I don't know. The next things that we're doing are pulling out specifically Vineland written expression scores and looking at how they relate to brain response in those kids. Which will kind of be a backwards way of getting at also kind of, you know, reading skill.
Zach, you talked a little bit about lack of attending, but what about, do you work with children and do you have thoughts about children who find eye contact aversive from very early ages, you know, actively looking away because it's almost too powerful?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think we can see empirically. I mean, there could be people for whom the eye contact response is deadened, and there could be people for whom the eye contact response is heightened. What we don't know is, you know, that, and I agree that clinically, sure, I think that there are people for whom eye contact can be aversive. I think that I don't know when I talk about these stages of processing, I don't know that would be reflected that early. You know, I mean, and Dr. Amaral can tell me whether I'm right or wrong, but I'm thinking of that something probably having reentrant feedback from like the amygdala, and I don't think that would necessarily be happening at that very, very early component. Maybe if we were looking at later components. But and the ERP can't record activity from the amygdala. We're only looking at it in terms of its kind of proxy effects on other cortical regions. But I think it's something very relevant, and we'll see. I mean, I think I'm not an autism spectrum absolutist. I think that it's a really, really messy definition. And, you know, this is not a, I didn't make up this term, there's probably lots and lots of autisms, right? And so there could be an autism where they're not getting the eye contact at all, and there could be an autism where they're steering away from it because it's too arousing. So I think it's a really, really, really important question, but I don't have the data to answer it yet. But I think that we can. And one of the paradigms I didn't show, so I showed the making the eye contact. We have another experiment where we have when you look, the face is either looking at you or looking away. And when you look to it, it either returns your gaze or averts your gaze. And so we don't yet have a paradigm where we can make the person on the spectrum look away, but we can see how they respond to returned or averted gaze.
So for someone like myself, who doesn't know a whole lot about autism and what to look out for, what's the most effective and efficient way for someone like me to communicate with an autistic individual face to face? You know, tonality, body language, eye contact. Can you just?
There's an incredibly complicated question.
Sorry.
But I'll give it a shot. Okay. So I would say, just to raise the level of complexity, you've asked me to address verbal and nonverbal behavior, right? So I would say, I would presume that the nonverbal behavior may not be registering so much. I would not rely on that entirely. I would keep your language simple. I would avoid figurative language, and I would be direct and concise.
A very fascinating research about facial recognition. Is there any research about for people with autism in terms of recognizing faces in other ways, like verbally, by the sound of someone's voice? Or do people with autism recognize other people with their voice the same as typically developing people?
It's a great question, and I can't answer it from my data. There are studies about voice, brain response to voices in autism. I'm not aware of a study that looked at the familiarity of the voice, but I can also say anecdotally is I think that many people on the spectrum are proficient at using those kinds of cues to make up for some of the difficulties in recognizing faces visually. There was a person that I worked with when I was in graduate school, and I would see him in the community often, and he would walk right past me unless I said hello. But if I said hello, he would immediately cue in to who I was. And so I think that, yeah, there's lots of ways. It was one of the first things when we first did in graduate school a study with Jerry with three-year-olds, and we showed that they didn't show the ERP markers of brain response to familiar faces. And it wasn't, it was the idea was misperceived and was seen as hurtful to some, saying, like, no. People with autism do recognize their parents. And yes, of course. It's just there's many, many ways to kind of solve the problem of figuring out who a person is. And so maybe these pathways are not being used in the same way. So I think that maybe some people with autism are much better at some of these alternative ways of recognizing people. Or other clues. This was a person that I didn't interface with, but who preceded me in Jerry's lab, who knew people by their earrings. So he had figured out a great strategy for recognizing women. It was problematic when graduate students borrowed one another's earrings.
I'm curious what it was like when you were collecting your data on the eye contact game, what it was like to have an individual with autism sit down and play the game, and how long it lasted, and what was their motivation for making eye contact with a face on the screen and then receiving a smile. And because that could, that does seem like a good therapeutic tool, but I'm wondering what it was like to how they participated in the study.
It remains to be seen. I mean, so that video you saw is really where the game, stands. The latest incarnation of the game is really super cool to someone geekily interested in the technology. But just on Friday, what Adam has built now is this. He's just to kind of see, to address the challenge of getting a more sophisticated crosstalk between eye contact and the computer, he's now built these. It's almost like playing a monotonic piano with your eyes, but he's built these squares around the screen, and when you look to a square, it changes colors and plays a sound. So that's the next step of kind of getting these more sophisticated. But the games don't exist yet. They're something that we're working to build. And we're also not... we're not savvy at building games. And so we're working with, so Fred Schick is a colleague at the Child Study Center who actually in a former life before coming to Autism Research was a video game designer. And so he's helping us think about ways to, you know, we have to make it boring enough so that we can collect the kind of information that we want to collect, but engaging enough that we can do it. And some of these things are hard. So I don't have the answer for the game, but in terms of the eye contact experiments, it's hard. All of these ERP experiments are hard for people on the spectrum, for everybody, because we have to do the same thing lots of times to get the data that we need. And so it's repetitive and monotonous, and I think the eye tracking ones are seen as particularly difficult, perhaps because we're forcing them to look at the eyes.
I've been thinking about the term you're using, true reciprocity. And I can see how the concept of shared attention, dyadic engagement is a core piece to that. But then I also keep going back to this togetherness, this the essence of having that social relationship with someone too. Yeah, and how that, again, builds into your whole work on the social motivation, or maybe now social engagement. So then thinking about the technology part to it and this kind of exciting exciting app or software program that you're building, I could see how that could be a really helpful primer for building again or helping someone pay more attention, pay faster attention to someone. But how do you really get at, again, that core inner drive to connect with someone, to engage with someone, to approach and stay involved with someone that I think really separates, you know, or is a kind of
right.
distinguishing
feature.
Right. How do you
affect motivation itself?
Yeah, because otherwise, like when I know that the game is new and still under development, but it reminds me of pieces of just conditioning, you know, where I'm responding to a stimulus.
No, I think that's what this is.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear. So I'm a clinician, and I do not intend to put myself out of a job. I don't think of these things as things that will supplant clinical contact, interpersonal relationships, and understanding of social relationships of people with autism. These are tools, for me, tools really for studying the brain, right? I mean, so when I say true reciprocity, I don't mean like this is going to make people socially adept. I mean, it's going to let me look at a brain response in a way that is legitimately interactive, but not legitimately personal in any way. So that's my disclaimer. But and I hope it didn't come off that way. I am very cynical about the idea that we are going to have, you know, my EEG machine or anything like that that's going to diagnose autism in an efficient way. There's just so much variability. I think that the people are right now the best arbiter of social function and dysfunction. I don't see that changing for a while until we have different kinds of biological markers. But so how do you change social motivation? Well, that's what people have been trying to do for a long time, and people have been trying to do it using classical conditioning methods, right? Because it doesn't matter. One idea is it doesn't matter how you get the person to engage with another person. Hopefully you can convince them that it's fun, right? And that some of it takes. And so that's it. And I think meeting a child where their interests lie, right? I mean, I think that you can't, there's different approaches to intervention, and I'm really, compared to the experts in this room, the least qualified to talk about this, but I'll go ahead anyway. the idea that, the purely, things that are purely child-directed are might not be so helpful because you could get stuck doing what the child wants to do, and you need to be steering away from some of that. But there's also got to be a meeting of the minds, right, where you're engaging in ways with the child that are edifying to the child, but are directing them to the kinds of things that are helpful for what's, for what's social and what's adaptive in the rest of the world. And so I think that, and then the other possibility is if there's other things that we can do, like medications, like if we can do something, like I'm not an oxytocin zealot by any stretch, but I think it's worth looking. If it can potentiate a person's receptiveness to certain kinds of information, then maybe that can help. Like, but in the context of a therapy, for example. That's the million-dollar question: is how do you improve social motivation? And coming from the son of two high school teachers, not just kids for autism everywhere, right? Making someone do what they don't want to do is something that's hard to do.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.